From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back to This Green Earth. We're trying to get a hold of our second guest, Dr. Miriam Goldstein, with
the Center for American Progress.
Progress, right.
Yeah.
And we're going to be hopefully going to talk about
that's right. Any
change.
Minute now.
All right.
We'll be talking about impacts of climate change on our oceans and kind of how policy has changed over the past 4 years with relation to marine protected areas and fisheries management. And then we'll be looking at what we can expect from the Biden administration moving forward, what changes we might see, and kind of what are the measures that need to be taken to protect our oceans. So
a lot.
Yeah,
how about
there's
that?
A lot.
You know, we'll start there.
Yeah, it's funny because I think so often we hear about impacts on land of climate change. We talk so much less about how climate change is impacting our ocean. I think we hear about coral reefs and not too much else.
Right, because there's physical, chemical, and biological
right.
impacts.
Right.
So I believe we have. Okay. Let's
All right.
See.
So do we have our guest on the phone over there, Chris?
Dr. Goldstein, are you there?
I am here. Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks so much for joining us this morning. We're so happy to have you on. We just gave a brief introduction as we were getting you lined up. And I think a great way to kick it off is just to talk about, you know, what impacts climate change has on our oceans, is having on our oceans. And we were just saying, you know, you hear so much about how climate change impacts land and our terrestrial ecosystems, but you don't hear as much when it comes to our oceans. You hear about maybe coral reefs and bleaching events, but
sea
not,
level rise,
but not all
obviously,
right. Sea level rise, but maybe not all that much else. So, talk to us a little bit about how our oceans are being impacted.
Yeah, absolutely. The oceans are actually literally taking the heat from all the carbon emissions and other greenhouse gases that we put into the air. The oceans have absorbed more than 90% of the excess heat that would have made our climate maybe even 10 degrees hotter than it is now if the oceans
wow.
had not absorbed it. So but that heat has to go somewhere, and it's going into the ocean. So we're seeing the waters are directly warming, and that is causing massive changes of where animals and plants and seaweeds can be found. They're moving north to get to cooler waters. So that means that fish that used to be off of the Carolinas, for example, on the East Coast, are now found off New Jersey. And fish that used to be found more off New Jersey are now found in New England. And this has already happened. This is happening right now. And you can see it when, like, some of the fishing fleets, like the Carolina fishermen have licenses to fish the fish that are no longer in the Carolinas. They actually have to motor to New Jersey. So the ocean is hotter. But there's another, what's called the evil twin of climate change in the ocean, called ocean acidification. And that is a chemical reaction that happens when carbon dioxide is absorbed into the ocean. And it interacts with carbon that's already dissolved in the ocean. It makes the water more acidic. So it is just absolutely disastrous for ocean life, because a lot of ocean life is things that are shells, that have shells or bones. So, like, that's pretty much everything. You know, it's fish and clams and mussels, things that we eat. They're made out of the shell that is literally dissolving in more acidic water. So the oceans are just really seeing these dramatic changes. And that's not even without getting to the sea ice melting in the poles and with the coral reefs directly getting too hot. It's bad. It's bad. But I don't want to be so hopeless. There's a lot that we can do.
All right. Well, let's stay on the hopeless part first for a few minutes.
We just want to wallow in that.
Yeah, because that's what Nell and I do. For the last 10 years on this show. But actually, it's really interesting because, if I understand it, increased levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are resulting in the oceans doing what they want to do, which is absorb that CO2. But then that CO2 combines with water and turns into basically carbonic acid, and that's the acidification that's going on, which drops which shows up in lowering pH levels, right?
Exactly right. That was a great explanation.
Okay. And so how much of a drop in pH are we talking about?
Oh, I do not have that at the top of my head. But I can tell you that we're already seeing the effects.
Okay.
For example, there are shellfish farms in Washington State and in Maine, which all of a sudden they couldn't grow up their baby shellfish. So they would try to be growing like clams and oysters, and the babies wouldn't grow up because when they're babies, they have these tiny, thin little shells, and they were just dissolving, like right there in the sort of the hatchery. So they actually ended up having to sort of artificially make their water more basic, raise the pH, so basically put extra alkaline into it to allow their baby shellfish to grow up to be farmed. So we're already seeing these effects directly in the ocean.
Okay. So there's a great example of, like you talk about physical impacts, sea level rise, and sea ice melt and land ice melt. And so water levels are rising. There's the chemical impacts associated with, acidification. And then those two things result and warmer temperatures in general result in biological impacts to shellfish, sea life, migrating farther north, etc. So it's all linked together, and it's been going on for the last 15, 20, 20 years or so?
Well, we've been able to see some of these warming patterns in the ocean for a number of decades. But it's really starting to accelerate. For example, the Gulf of Maine off the coast of Maine is warming faster than 99% of the rest of the ocean. Like, it's already happening. Like, for example, if I could invest, I'd invest in Chesapeake blue crabs making their home in Boston, off of Boston, because that's already happening.
Mm. Wow.
We have known about these effects and been able to measure them for a number of decades, but I think now it's happened and continuing to accelerate so that regular people can see it in their daily lives more clearly, as opposed to, you know, scientists taking specialized measurements in the deep sea.
So do you have a sense of how all these changes and shifts in, you know, range are impacting overall populations of our fish, our shellfish? You know, sort of, I know that's a big question and it probably varies by species, but can you give us like a broad brushstroke on that?
Yeah, maybe I'll give you a really sad example and explain how it impacts everything. So it was just last week, the sunflower starfish, which is one of the biggest starfishes in the world. It lives off the coast of California, Oregon, and Washington. It was declared critically endangered by the IUCN, an international conservation body. And this starfish used to be incredibly common off the coast. It's a really impressive animal. It would be, you know, like maybe a foot or even 2 feet across, a very large starfish. And you say, like, well, why does this starfish matter? I mean, why do, like, scientists care about cool starfish? Does anyone else? But it turns out this starfish likes to eat sea urchins along with everything else. And the reason that it disappeared, and there's very few left compared to how many there used to be, more than 90% are gone, is because of sea star wasting disease, a disease that affected sea stars that is linked to warmer waters. So the disease killed off a lot of starfish, but especially this species. They stopped eating sea urchins. The sea urchins exploded in population and started to eat the kelp forest. Mm-hmm. And the kelp forest was hit with a double whammy because not only was it getting hit by sea urchins, but the warmer waters were actually also hindering the kelp's growth and reproduction. And the kelp forest is the home to so many species, including commercially important fisheries off of the West Coast, but they just got decimated by sea urchins just directly eating the kelp. And so these are some of the effects and these unexpected food chain effects that we see in these warming waters, that this warming waters could make this one particular disease that only affects sea stars worse, but then you have this chain reaction. And so right now, the kelp forests off the West Coast, which, you know, used to be vast and supported huge amounts of life, are really in trouble as directly linked to these warming waters and to the urchin population boom. So I hope that's just one example, but right. I hope that is sort of illustrative of the kind of things that can happen.
No, I think we did a story a few weeks ago about the impacts of kelp forest deforestation, we'll call it,
yeah.
on sea otter populations too, because otters live, depend on kelp forests for protection as well as food. So that's another species that's being impacted by, and again, it's all linked together, going back to the sea star. Okay, so short of us dumping a whole lot of alkaline into the ocean and returning, you know, trying to control pH levels, what are some of the hopeful aspects to this story?
Well, the hopeful aspect of this story is we've talked a lot about the bad effects that climate change is having on the ocean. And that, I mean, that is true and it is happening. But the ocean is not just a victim of climate change. It can be a hero too. And there are so many things the ocean can do to help directly reduce the impact of climate change, to help prevent emissions and to ensure that the ocean can continue to provide all of these services that we depend on, like food and protection from storms. So recently there has been a lot of really amazing work showing the amazing role that the ocean can play in climate action. The most recent of which in the U.S. is a bill called the Ocean-Based Climate Solutions Act that was just introduced in October by the House Natural Resources Committee Chair Raul Grijalva, who's a congressman, leads that committee from Arizona. And that is really a watershed piece of legislation for the U.S., showing that all the things that the ocean can do to fight climate change. It includes directly reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So, for example, it prohibits new oil and gas leasing offshore, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico, where it is right now. And, like, obviously the first thing we have to do is stop emitting more carbon into the atmosphere. So it takes that measure. It also sets a national goal for offshore wind energy so that we can have the clean energy that we need to grow our economy, but also to protect both people and the ecosystem. So along with the direct reductions, it also helps the ocean to store carbon directly. And that is through supporting what's called blue carbon ecosystems. Those are ecosystems like salt marshes, seagrass, and mangroves that actually take carbon out of the atmosphere and safely store it away. And ocean ecosystems they're really coastal. They're not out in the open ocean, but they're on the coast. They can store about 4 times more carbon per acre than forests on land. They're extremely effective at taking carbon out of the air and storing it safely away. But they have other advantages too. These ecosystems directly protect coastal communities from our increasingly severe storms that we're seeing on both coasts. So they provide direct protection from flooding and waves and wave action. And they also directly enhance fisheries and biodiversity, because these ecosystems are very important for especially baby fish and baby shellfish to grow up in. So the bill does that. And then finally, promoting coastal resiliency, which is to say helping the ocean and coast to protect communities from the climate impacts that we can't avoid. So it takes those measures, including helping to rebuild those coastal ecosystems that I just mentioned. That's very good for the economy. It creates a lot of jobs. And it also sets a goal of protecting 30% of the ocean by 2030 and sets a pathway for how we can do that, a process for how we can do that. It does lots of other things. But I really think that this is an exciting roadmap going forward for how we can look to the ocean for climate solutions, both to protect itself and to protect us.
It is exciting to hear. And like you said, we depend on the ocean for so many things, whether it's, you know, food or, you know, I guess those coastal ecosystems protecting us from storms. But I want to talk a little bit more about those marine protected areas. I think that under the Trump administration, there was some pressure to decrease their protections. And the reasoning behind that was to increase commercial fishing opportunities. Is that right?
Well, that was the what the Trump administration said. The problem is it was like not really supported by the facts on the ground. So the National Marine Monuments that Trump did reduce protections for was the Northeast Canyons and Seamounts Marine National Monument, which is off the coast of southern New England and New York, far off the coast. So in the Trump administration's own press conference rolling back the protections, the fishermen who he was talking to in there said, well, we don't actually fish out there. It's too far off the coast. So that particular reducing protections in that monument does not enhance fisheries in any significant way, but it does put ancient deep sea corals at severe risk from just like a little bit of fishing activity. Unfortunately, you just trawl them once and they're gone. These can be multiple thousands of years old, so they really have to be protected. And didn't actually address the problems that, you know, they purported to address by this rollback, which was economic hardship in particularly the Maine lobster fishery, which is very real. But the problem is it didn't have anything to do with the monument. It was related to the Trump administration's own trade war with China, which reduced the opportunity to sell lobster. Mm. And it was also related to the COVID crisis affecting, you know, seafood sales and marketing. But mostly it was China, and it was the Trump administration's own trade war that was causing this economic hardship. The monument having it didn't affect that, and rolling it back didn't help, unfortunately. Mm.
Plus, aren't the lobster all just walking north, too, as the waters in the Gulf of Maine warm?
Oh, yes. The lobsters are walking north. I mean, you know, I like to think I'm not that old, but I still remember when I'm from New England, and I remember when there was a Rhode Island and Massachusetts, a thriving lobster fishery, and that, because of a combination of warming waters and the shell disease in lobster, another disease linked to warming waters, those lobster fisheries are just tiny fractions of their former selves. And the lobsters that used to be there are now in Maine, but they're not stopping in Maine. They are going to Canada. And that is something that Maine fishermen are very well aware of and are very active and aware of these climate problems in their state. So there's a lot of work going on there between the lobster fishery and then the shellfish farming industry, which is affected by ocean acidification. But yeah, no, it's a really significant issue. And frankly, the only thing we need to do, the most effective thing we can do about it, is to stop putting yet more carbon into the atmosphere. Like, that is the single most important thing, is to stop emitting greenhouse gases as fast as we can. And right now, the goal that President-elect Biden has put forth is net zero emissions by 2050, which would hold us to an increase of 2 degrees Celsius globally. And that's still a lot for the lobsters in Maine, but like, that is still, it's both like, that's a lot of heat that's going to be in the ocean, especially in Maine, but also that's an extremely ambitious goal, but it's what we have to do to protect, you know, these fisheries and these ways of life from, you know, in this case, going to Canada.
Well, I want to add some encouraging news to that, because I just brought up a chart from the Energy Information Administration with respect to U.S. coal consumption over the past 5 or 6 decades. And it peaked somewhere around 2008, around 11, just, you know, for the numbers, 1,100 million short tons coal burned per year. Since then, it's dropped almost on a year-over-year basis to where in 2019, we're down to roughly 600 million short tons of coal consumed by U.S. consumers. That's almost, well, half from the peak. And that number continues to decline. 600 million tons, just to give you perspective, that's the amount of coal we burned back in, say, 1975. So we're turning back the clock with respect to the coal that we consume and the amount of renewables that are replacing it, solar and wind. So those are encouraging signs. Of course, the nature won't see those impacts for quite a while because of the lag, because ultimately we want to get carbon dioxide levels, concentrations in the atmosphere down. That hasn't happened quite yet. We want it to level off first, don't we? How about that?
Yeah, exactly. That would be... I mean, I think that right now, as fast and as low as we can reduce them would be to our own direct benefit.
Yes.
So we've got just a couple of minutes left, and wanted to ask, you know, if our listeners are interested in learning more about, you know, marine policy and your recommendations, where would you recommend that they go?
Oh, great question. I wish we had one snazzy little site for it. You know, I'm just going to plug myself, if that's okay.
I tweet
about this all the time. And people are also, because I don't know that I could send people to a bunch of different places. So people who want to learn more should find me on Twitter. I'm at Miriam Goldstick. Sadly, I didn't get the rest of my name. MiriamGoldstick. And I tweet about this stuff, but I also, if you reach out to me, I will point you in the direction or to the people who are working on what you're interested in. But this is a great reminder. We should have like a simple landing page for all this stuff. But we don't yet.
Okay.
You also, I have noted here, have a number of kind of posts on the Center for American Progress website where you talk about some of the issues that we've talked about today as well that might be a good resource.
We do, yes. And we and also it's on all kinds of things, really. I mean, all things across the spectrum, but on our energy and environment team, we have lots and lots of information on everything from ocean policy, climate policy, environmental justice. So definitely encourage folks to check us out on the web, especially if you like to get wonky. We're very wonky.
I love it. Well, that's all at AmericanProgress.org, and that's Dr. Miriam Goldstein. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to talk about the ocean.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.